Good afternoon. We're back with another episode of the Sean Mo Hoops podcast, and pleased to have a special guest today in Vince Nicastro, the Chief Operating Officer and Deputy Commissioner of the Big East and former Villanova Athletic Director. Vince, how are you doing today?
Doing great, Sean. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be with you.
All right. Well, we first met a little over a year ago, and I was very intrigued by your entry into sports as well as at Villanova and now in the Big East. And as an aside, I'm a ACC guy going to UNC and watch ACC hoops, but I do have to say that the Big East to me was the most entertaining conference to watch last year basketball-wise, and it's shown through with Villanova and getting two number one seeds. So congratulations to your team and everybody involved.
Yeah, thanks. We had a great year. We've had a really terrific sort of restart of the league 5 years ago. So through this first 5 years of this 10-team configuration of the Big East, we've had tremendous success, you know, obviously led by Villanova, but the depth of the league has really been impressive, and we expect the same this year.
Touch on the current state of the Big East and the role you played in helping that, but wanted to kind of jump back. And the reason kind of, I think we first met was, well, you were much smarter than me and that you were in accounting as an undergrad and did a year, and you got out a lot quicker than I did. But can you kind of take me back to how you really got your start in the sports business industry?
Yeah. And I don't know if I'm much smarter than you. I've never been accused of that, Sean, but yeah. So as I was, working my way through college, and I was an undergraduate at Bloomsburg University, which is a Division II Pennsylvania state school that, if you're not from Pennsylvania, probably have never heard of. You know, at the time I was kind of focused on trying to get a respectable job upon graduation, and I was in the accounting curriculum there, and graduated and got it, at the time was a terrific job. And frankly, that training has really helped in my career all the way through up till now. But it wasn't, you know, long after I was working in the accounting field, I sort of missed being part of a team. I missed sports. You know, had played in high school and a couple of sports in high school, and just was kind of thinking about ways I could make a living around sport. And there weren't many very obvious entry points at that point of time in the mid-80s. So I considered maybe getting a teaching degree and going back and teaching and coaching in high school. But I did eventually stumble upon, after talking to a number of people, a graduate program in sports management at Temple University, which, again, 30-some years ago, they weren't nearly as prevalent as they are today, and there were only really a handful in the country. And fortunately, I had one sort of in my backyard in Philadelphia. So I went down to see the program director there, Dr. Michael Jackson, who's still there. He signed me up sort of right away as a pending my full admission into the program. So I enrolled in the program, and I continued to work full time. And went to school full time at night. But that allowed me to sort of launch an internship and make the break from the accounting business into the sports business as I got my first internship in minor league baseball after about a year and a half in the program.
After minor league baseball, where you got to most likely have your hands in a lot of different. And when did you kind of make that transition into the collegiate athletic world?
Yeah, and you're right. Minor league baseball, and to this day, I love people who work in that space. I mean, it is a really, really important sort of proving ground for young professionals. You generally have small operations, so you do get your hands on just about every piece of it. It can be a grueling schedule. You know, baseball is unforgiving, and day after day after day, and you know, you leave the ballpark late at night and you come back the next morning and do it again. It's literally the grind, but a great experience and great training. So our, at the time, franchises were flipping pretty rapidly. The values of franchises were escalating. So it wasn't unusual during that period of time for owners to buy teams, operate them for short periods of time, maybe not even full seasons, and then flip the teams and sell them to other owners. And so ours was the same. I worked for a franchise in Williamsport, Pennsylvania. About midway through the season, our owner said he had just executed an agreement of sale, and the team was moving to another city. He had owned a few other operations that he was going to try to place us in. But it really just spurred me to start looking for work, you know, at that point.
Right.
I was young and was just looking for a job. And I ended up kind of the old-fashioned way, right, the Sunday want ads, applying for a job at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, you know, near where I grew up. And I interviewed right at the end of our summer season in baseball, and then ended up getting the job like right after Labor Day. So it worked out really well that this transition from the professional baseball, minor league baseball world into college athletics, it was a little bit out of just necessity, not necessarily intentional. But when I worked there, I was called something like director of tickets and promotion. So I ran the box office and did some group selling and some corporate sponsorship and some game day promotional work. For a young person, it was a lot of the responsibilities I had in the minor league baseball world, and we sort of translated them over into college basketball and other sports. So it's a great tradition and a great experience. And then as I got more involved in the collegiate landscape, I really felt strongly about my commitment towards college athletics and this strange but I think important integration of academics and sports, and you know, how does that all work together? And it's the most unique and distinctive model in the world. It's not without its warts, but I really believe strongly in the importance of it.
Okay, fantastic. And that led to, you know, at a young age getting the athletic director job at Villanova, and kind of going back to, I think it was probably maybe after your first year, but at the time Steve Lapis was of his career at Villanova, and all of a sudden I think you guys were looking for a new coach. And I didn't even realize this story until a few days ago, because you think of Jay Wright and obviously the success that he has had, but it seemed that he was almost the head coach at Rutgers before you guys kind of swayed him to Villanova, which obviously changed a lot of paths and a lot of things in the basketball world. But just going back to that 2001 time, how was kind of the Jay Wright recruitment and how did you get him to Villanova?
Yeah, so we were really fortunate. But just to back up a little bit, so when my path to the AD's chair at Villanova, again, was very unintentional, and I'm really fortunate that the stars aligned there. I did move from St. Joe's to Villanova, and I started working for Gene DeFilippo, who was the athletic director at the time. And Gene was really making a tremendous amount of positive change at Villanova, which created opportunity for a lot of us. And he continued to give me a lot of responsibility. And then he left to go to Boston College. And then his successor was only there a short period of time. And so in a sort of a unintentional roundabout way, our president promoted me into the AD's chair in a very early stage of my career, as you had mentioned. And then lo and behold, after, you know, getting the job, trying to figure it out, which you know, usually takes a while. We have a coaching transition in our most important program, men's basketball. So a pretty tough test for a young AD. And we're really fortunate that, you know, Jay had been an assistant at Villanova. So a lot of us had a good relationship with him. And he had had real success at Hofstra, taking them from really being one of the worst programs in the country as a 32-year-old head coach, I think, at the time, and getting them into the NCAA tournament his last couple of years there. And so he was ready and had the resume, and fortunately had this very strong connection to Villanova. You know, he cut his teeth with Rolly Massimino. His wife is an alum. He grew up not far from Villanova, so his family was there. So he had a really strong connection to the place. He was, as you mentioned, right at the altar with Rutgers. So the timing is everything. If we had hesitated another 24 hours, I'm not sure he would have been available. So it was again, we were fortunate. The stars were aligned. And I felt, you know, the athletic director at Rutgers, a gentleman named Bob Mulcahy, who's also a Villanova alum, was on our board at one point in time. Many of his kids and grandchildren have attended Villanova. And for me personally, as a young AD, he was a great mentor to me when Rutgers was in the Big East. He sort of took me under his wing and treated me like, you know, one of the veteran ADs. And so it was a little painful to kind of pull Jay out of that realm, but he understood. I mean, he was phenomenal. Disappointed, obviously, but he understood how important Villanova basketball was to Jay, and that was a dream job. And you know, here we are, I don't know, 18 or 19 years later, and what Jay has done with that program has been just remarkable.
Yeah, and for the program, he had great early success, really, throughout the whole, you know, first 9 to 10 years of his career. I'm kind of curious from a character perspective, after you guys reached the Final Four in 2009, there was kind of a few what some people would consider down years right after, and obviously Jay had done enough to over the 10 years to be very well respected, but from an athletic director perspective, basketball is your main sport. All of a sudden you have one or two down years. What type of pressure is on you or the university? I've always just been curious about what an athletic director is kind of going through when one of their major sports starts to just have a day.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, fortunately at Villanova, the university has had a very sort of balanced view of the world. Make no mistake about it, the expectations for basketball are really high, and everyone knows, you know, what comes with that. But you know, we had, I think, one losing year, and then there were a couple of sort of early stumbles in the NCAA tournament. But there was, you know, never any real pressure, at least that I can recall, in terms of Jay's leadership and his future with the program. There may have been some, you know, scuttlebutt amongst the media or fans, but at Villanova, the leadership there, you know, the president and others, board, myself. I mean, there was never any wavering about Jay's ability to lead the program and lead it to success. I will say that one of the things that has that I've admired about Jay's leadership was around that time. You know, you reach the Final Four, which you sort of think it might be the pinnacle,
right?
And then all of a sudden, I mean, we had recruited really good players, but all of a sudden now you're getting, you know, top 15 type players. You're beating the Kansases, Louisville's, and Dukes, and North Carolina's for players in the recruiting battles. And frankly, you know, some of those teams, they had great talent, but the pieces didn't fit together as well as you would have liked as a coach. And Jay could have just kept on going and getting those kids and winning 25 games a year, would have been fine. But he made an intentional decision to step back and say, do I want to keep doing that, or do I want to build a team? And I want to get really good, talented players, but there may be some people that, you know, won't fit either my scheme or fit culturally or fit positionally. And I want to be more thoughtful about not just chasing the top 10 players in the country. And for him to do that at that stage of his career, I thought was really admirable and difficult to do. And I think what you're seeing over the past few years, are the fruits of that strategy change. And to make that change again, when you're successful, you've just what you think may have been the pinnacle of your career it's remarkable to be able to do that. So I give him a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, we've seen have turned out for him and the program. But you mentioned change, and really you were in the main circle of change, of really conference realignment, teams being pulled from the Big East, and kind of a new rumor about what was going to happen. But you were really kind of in the center point of being at the time closely with the Big East. Can you kind of take me back to that? I assume the craziness of what was going on, but really the direction and leadership that you provided to really stabilize the Big East and Villanova and kind of transition into, where we are now.
Well, during my tenure as AD at Villanova, we had a couple of rounds of pretty severe realignment activity. So the first was in 2000, like 3, 4, and 5. Mm-hmm. We had Miami, BC, and Virginia Tech leave to go to the ACC. And then we pieced it together. Again, I was a young AD. We had football was still, a really integral part of what we were doing. Mike Trangisi did a great job of, really developing the 16-team model that became pretty successful. We had 11 of those 16 teams in the tournament one year, I think 2009, which is remarkable. But we all knew that the football-basketball combo with the changing nature of college football was not going to be sustainable forever. So the basketball schools, we had always kept thinking, planning, and trying to be thoughtful about, what would our future look like if, in fact, a lot of the traditional football schools, many of them were great in basketball, by the way, Syracuse and Louisville and Notre Dame and others, if they decided to go their own way. And that's what started to happen in, 2011, 12 timeframe. So we had done a lot of thinking around what would happen, what would our future look like. So fortunately, we were prepared, at least conceptually. And our presidents did a courageous thing when in late 2012, the seven, what were being termed the Catholic Seven, schools who were basketball centric schools decided to go ahead and exercise an option in our membership agreement that allowed us to split as a group of seven and go our own way. And that didn't come without a lot of anxiety. I can tell you, we were concerned about how we would be perceived nationally. Would we have a national television platform? Would we be able to generate the same type of revenue and income against an asset that was strong but different, right? Didn't include those, maybe some of those traditional Big East powerhouses. And so it took some courage, I think, for our presidents and our athletic directors to say, let's control our own destiny here and get out of the tumultuous environment and try to form a league that has some coherence, makes sense, has some alignment, come back to being really very focused and intentional about playing at the highest level in basketball. And within about a 75-day period in early 2013, we separated from the 16-team Big East, or what was left of it at the time. We attracted three new schools, Butler, Xavier, and Creighton, who've brought great value to our 10-team configuration. We constructed a 12-year national television deal with Fox, who hadn't even launched FS1. It was all on the coming launch of FS1 as a 24-hour national cable network, which didn't launch until August. So we were sort of betting on each other. And looking back on it, were we anxious? Were we unsure? Were we uncertain? Yeah, I think we all were. But we felt strongly about, you know, if we can control our own destinies, if we can continue to keep our collective, you know, 10 schools, you know, foot on the gas, so to speak, to make sure that we're doing everything possible to maintain our prominence in basketball, that we could make it work. And, you know, looking back over the last 5 years, it's worked and then some. I mean, to have two national championships, you know, we may not do that again, right, realistically.
Right.
To have the number of teams, I think we've averaged 60% of our membership has made the NCAA tournament annually over the 5 years. And I think the public has now, hopefully, you know, we don't want to rest on the laurels, but I think the public has now accepted that this group of 10 is amongst the elite basketball conferences in the country. So it's I feel like we've arrived, but in some respects, you never have arrived because it's such a dynamic environment.
Yeah, well, speaking of the dynamic environment, obviously, it's going on now in the basketball world. It was only a year ago where the FBI investigation came, and now the NCAA has been looking at their rule changes. And from a league perspective, not really knowing the direction, whether it's, you know, the summer AAU or some of these other rules, from a league perspective, how do you guys look at the changing landscape and try to, you know, set yourselves up for continued future success?
That's a great question. And it's actually one of the, you know, as I've moved from campus to the conference office, the conference office is a place where you can actually affect some of those changes when you have an issue like this, because you're dealing with, you know, big picture policy strategy matters. When you're on a campus, it's really hard to do that. But at the conference level, we've been heavily engaged, you know, since the indictments were handed down about a year ago, and then the Commission on College Basketball was formed. So we've been able to play, I think, an important influential role in some of the changes that have been proposed and adopted by the membership. We had three representatives. There were eight working groups on the Rice Commission implementation teams. Three of those eight working groups were chaired by Big East representatives. Val Ackerman chaired one regarding the NBA draft rules. Greg Christopher, the AD at Xavier, chaired one regarding the new penalty and infractions processes that were adopted. And then Jack DeGioia, who's the president at Georgetown, was chairing the some of the academic components. So I feel like we've been able to, particularly in basketball, because that's what we're really focused on, where other conferences, you know, have football on the radar this time of the year.
Right.
You know, we were able to really, I think, play an important role in making some of those changes. And there are more to come. I mean, I don't think that one process is going to resolve all the issues that were brought to the table a year ago. But I think it's a good example of how the conference office can help affect some of those changes.
Yeah, well, it'll definitely be interesting to see how the landscape shakes out with the summer basketball and one and done and all the rules that are up in the air right now, especially as the 2018-19 season kicks off. One just last question for you. I know I all of talking about basketball, the Big East, and some of the roles that you've played. But moving over to the Big East, and you mentioned Val Ackerman. She is regarded as one of the top executives, you know, throughout the sports industry. I'm curious about how it was working with her and some of the things that you might have, you know, been able to pick up from working with her on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I've been fortunate to work for and with a lot of really, really talented, bright leaders. And coming here to work with Val, obviously, I had known her. my work at Villanova, and I, as you said, not just because I think she's often referred to as one of the top women executives in all of sport, but I think just simply one of the top executives in all of sports. You know, working with David Stern, she was the founding president of the WNBA, launched, and then what she's accomplished here as a commissioner here. She was the chair of USA Basketball. I mean, was on the board of FIBA. So she has incredible a range of experiences at the executive level. Tremendously hardworking, really thoughtful and intelligent, and well prepared. I haven't seen anyone as prepared for, you know, meetings, events, presentations as Val. And at this stage of her career, she probably could rest on some of her laurels, but doesn't at all, which I think has made her exceptional.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to thank you for coming onto the podcast and sharing some, Villanova to now where you currently reside with the Big East. Excited to see how the upcoming basketball season turns out, but thank you again for coming on to chat.
My pleasure, Sean. Hope to talk to you soon.
That wraps up another edition of the Sean Mo Hoops Pod with Vince Nicastro, the Deputy Commissioner and Chief Operating Officer of the Big East. With that podcast, we're getting close to the one-year anniversary of the initial recording, and want to thank everyone that has listened over the last 12 months. College basketball practices have also kicked off, and the podcast will now return to a weekly scheduling with a lot of exciting guests coming up. Talk to you guys soon.